T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
We've got 89 degrees, partly cloudy skies, wind out of the northwest at 11. It is 5:10 on a sticky, steamy, sauna-like WCCO Sports Saturday. Eric Nelson with you here until 6 o'clock. J-Lo, Jonathan Lowe, is our studio coordinator. And in the newsroom, Sloan Martin. A segment we do periodically here on WCCO called Sports in the Courts. And the star of the show is Lee Hutton, Twin Cities Entertainment and sports lawyer. Lee joins us now. How you doing, Lee?
How you doing? It's a beautiful Saturday morning, or Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, absolutely. You staying cool?
I am. More state tournament baseball, but it's cool. It's cool. It's they're winning, so I'm a happy, proud dad.
Where are you at?
Well, right here, we're in Lakeville.
Lakeville, okay. Yeah, my kid's playing in Eden Prairie. I know that's a lot of tournaments going on the last couple of weekends. So, well, that's good stuff, watching baseball on a 90-degree day. Can't beat that.
That's right. Two proud papas.
Yeah, just like Texas. I mean, you grew up in Texas. This is the norm, isn't it?
Minus the humidity.
Yeah, it's a bit steamy today. A lot to get into, Lee, but let's start with locally. And I realize this isn't a sports-related issue, but it's certainly been major news globally. The shooting a week ago of Justine Damond by a Minneapolis police officer, Mohammed Noor, and it fostered the resignation of Janae Harto yesterday. We saw the attempted coup d'etat at City Hall last night when Mayor Betsy Hodges tried to hold the news conference. This thing has a lot of tentacles, doesn't it?
It really does, and this is the same issue in our environment of a microcosm of just thousands of years of bad behavior in America that's really just kind of playing itself out. We really haven't learned how to kind of coexist and live with one another. Now, when you take the topic with regard to police and enforcement and all the issues that a police officer has to deal with, and then how that interacts with our everyday citizens, and then you take the issue that America is still trying to get right, how do we live among the melting pot of cultural differences and cultural ideas and beliefs, which is really kind of the shield of what we conclude of what makes America great. Now, this is a situation that's unfortunately, and I hate to predict this, that is going to bring up the discussion of kind of the racial imbalance. You know, from what I understand of the facts, this was a domestic call, and not a domestic abuse call, but basically a noise violation. The Australian woman walks up to the police car, which at that time, it really is hard to argue in court that the two police officers would have been, quote, on high alert after being visiting a house on that type of call. The officer who happened to be a Somalian officer, the first Somalian in that fifth precinct, reacted and shot her to her death. And this is in conjunction with the hundreds of police shootings around the country, which ended up in acquittal. Now, if this one ends up in conviction of the officer, which it seems like the facts certainly may tend to lead that way, we may have another discussion again with regard to the racial imbalance. Now, whether or not that's a discussion that's fair to say, I don't know if that's necessarily the debate, but the debate certainly goes of what are we doing wrong with regard to police enforcement on both sides of the coin? How can we learn how to build that relationship between citizen and law enforcement? And then the relationship with the imbalance of when there is something wrong with the relationship between police and citizen, how do we make sure the punishment is consistent where there's no racial barriers or racial issues issues that come into play where somebody could say, hey, that is not typical standard of how we treat the conclusions in that. So this is going to be a very, very tough situation for Minneapolis. And not to mention, and I have to underscore this, and this is where we get back into the sports, Minneapolis is in a situation where all eyes across the world is looking at Minneapolis, not because this is dealing with a foreigner, but we have the Super Bowl coming up. And if we can't get our law enforcement and at least the perception of Minneapolis being safe, that is going to affect the success of the Super Bowl.
Well, you bring up a great point, Lee, and I was at the Super Bowl in February in Houston. And the day before the game, I'm walking through the convention center down there in downtown Houston, and I saw a number of Minneapolis police officers out of the blue. I saw Jhené Harto and a lot of people in her department, and they were being given a tour of the city by the Houston Police Department. And basically, they were taking notes, and the Houston Police Department, you know, they were letting them know, hey, here's what you're up against. Here's how colossal this event is. Here's what you're going to need to do to make sure you can pull it off safely. And Houston has a much bigger police force than Minneapolis. It's a larger city. But my point is, and I think to what you just said, is you have a department, fair or foul, that looks like it's in turmoil. Now we have, the new police chief, Arian Dondo, and he's the interim for at least 18 months, pending approval. But you have the Super Bowl coming. We just had the X Games here. So we are in the global spotlight, aren't we?
That's exactly right. Not to mention, we've had several shootings in downtown. And that is just slightly enough, number one, to make us look like we're not prepared for this big event. Number two, the question, and of course, you know me, I'm very critical because of my perfectionist attitude, but it makes us, if we can't handle the everyday interaction between citizen and law enforcement, how are we going to handle one of the largest, biggest stages on earth with multi-millions of people jammed in the city where we're having the significant problems? And right now, while, you know, I think there's many criticism both sides and whether or not Betsy Hodges' decision to or the resignation is the right decision, we have a new police chief with 6 months to go to get prepared for the biggest show on earth. We really have to kind of take a step back and figure out what we're doing wrong, not just as a department, but as a city of Minneapolis, because this can have long-lasting effects on the corporate market.
Yeah, and Minneapolis would be the micro level. On the macro level, I think the U.S. in general, there's a gun problem, Lee. I mean, we have police shootings are common. We have a mass shooting every 2 weeks in this country. We have random shootings going on routinely in major cities across the nation. I mean, Chicago is a war zone. So what you have now is a perception issue in other countries. And after this shooting, of course, Justine Damon from Australia, I read an article where, you know, the people in Australia, government officials are now saying, if you go to the U.S., you are at risk, that there's a chance that something could happen to you. And that's certainly not an image you want globally.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I can even tell you with my travels internationally, Australia is not the only country putting out that risk. I'm married to a Mexican woman. You go to Mexico, and while I think Americans have the same warnings when they go to certain areas of Mexico, Mexican citizens are getting that warning when they come here. And even while this is kind of part of the United States, even Puerto Rico was giving their residents who are coming to the United States that same advice to be careful.
Lee Hutton, our guest. We call it Sports in the Courts. We do it periodically right here on WCCO. All right, Lee, it's amazing because we had the resignation of Chief Harto yesterday, and that kind of eclipsed a lot of other major news, Sean Spicer resigning. And then just a couple of days ago, O.J. Simpson granted parole in Nevada. He will be out in October, the former Heisman Trophy winner, NFL legend, actor, etc. What will life be like for O.J. when they set him free?
It's going to be tough. I can tell you the juice may be loose, but it's not going to be an easy row ahead. You know, you have the Goldman family who still has that outstanding debt from the civil trial that they're successful on. OJ is going to be able to keep his pension. They're not going to be able to touch that. But the pension is not going to be able to satisfy his life. Now, he's about 70 years old, and he's going to most likely go to Florida, live with his adult children, and depending on his, whatever his life expectancy is, really hopefully live a quiet life that's undisturbed. Now, we're talking about OJ here. And while he may have the delusions that he can just walk down the street and go to a golf course, I don't think life is going to be that easy for him. He is not necessarily reacquainted with America. And you're also talking about an individual who hasn't been in modern society for the last 4 years. And so he's going to need a lot of counseling. He's going to have some, and I don't know what the scientific term is, but typically when you have individuals that are leaving that kind of captivity and then going out into the real world, there is a significant social adjustment that he's going to have to make. And you're looking at an individual like OJ, who is a star player, America's loved guy, got into a situation where he was in that made the United States really look internally on themselves. He's been coined a murderer and then not a murderer. And now he's back into modern society. It's going to be very, very difficult for him. And I'm not sure he's going to be prepared for that adjustment, but we'll see.
All right. He wants to go to Florida. And I think Nevada and Florida are working that out. How much will he have to adhere to the parole stipulations? And what if there's a slip-up? Does he go right back to Nevada?
Absolutely. He's going to go back to, if there's a parole violation, he is going to go back to Nevada. And you have to understand that many people are going to criticize and have criticized the parole board for letting him out early. Now, not just because of the issue that happened in Nevada where he took the kind of keystone approach to kind of steal his memorabilia back. But of course, you know, the sentiments and the emotions from the O.J. Simpson trial in California, people haven't forgot that. And so this is a situation where the parole board, while they check the boxes of their bureaucratic standards, and he was successful in getting that, they are under some scrutiny. And so if OJ slips up very minor, it's going to be televised, it's going to be shown, and they're not going to have much mercy.
Why are we, the public, fascinated by OJ Simpson?
You know, it's and that's a really good question. That's a 2-hour show within itself, Eric. But I think what it is, you know, you certainly have the story of rags to riches, black and white, success. It really is a microcosm of a reflection of everything that is right in America. A young black kid that goes to college and becomes really erases the race barrier and did that very successfully. And then you have the failures of this whole thing where he became larger than who he was. And, you know, the famous line that I'm not black, I'm OJ. And certainly that was kind of turning your back on the black community, where the black community says, God, I want to be like OJ because he was able to make it for whatever purpose it was. And so now he is now a criminal in the sense of the word. That while he was acquitted, he then had another incident that put him behind bars. And so this is this kind of win and love-hate relationship of the successes and failures in America. And I think it, we're so fascinated by it that we'll even televise a parole hearing because we're able to kind of see OJ's failures and say, wow, I don't want to be that guy, and then see his successes and say, wow, I wouldn't mind having those successes. And so, you know, just like reality TV, we love to kind of live vicariously through people who we have put it placed on the pedestal.
You know, and there's no doubt there's polarization right now in this country. But you go back to the early 90s, the acquittal in Los Angeles, that was a basically, I don't want to broad brush here, but most white Americans thought, hey, he got off. Most African Americans were saying, you know, this is payback. They were okay with it. Where do you think we are now in 2017? Do you think African Americans are saying, well, we aren't as behind OJ maybe as we were, or is it still the way it was?
You know, and I think that I will kind of tweak a little bit, Eric. I think the African American community really had no issue per se on whether OJ did it or not. It was the system. It was take the Rodney Keene situation where the system worked for the benefit of a video that a lot of people say, wow, I can't understand how the officers were acquitted. And then you go all the way back to the 1960s riots in Detroit, and then you even fast forward to everything that's happening today. And I think the OJ issue in a different spin is going to have somewhat of a reaction with regard to the Somalian police officer and whether or not he's convicted or acquitted. I mean, we've already seen kind of the police chief take some hits when she immediately came out and said, we have a problem with our police department, but was silent with regard to the Philando Castile shooting. And so I think the Black community is sitting here and saying, wow, have we won? Have we made it? What is resiliency like being African-American in the state of Minnesota or in the United States? And it's really hard to kind of take a win in the loss column because it seems like you're always tying, you know, because we haven't moved forward. It's really, really tough to say, Eric. I think we got a lot of work to do. Like I always say, you know, we're trying to correct thousands of years of bad behavior and we're really ignoring the issue. I come from Texas. And, you know, the discussion on slavery, the discussion on the 1960s, civil rights, it's mute when we come to our own American history. And I think that's one part of the problems.
Yeah, I can remember reading an article once written by a Canadian writer where he said, in our country, it's all about linguistics, English versus French. That's the wedge issue. In the U.S., it's race. And you know what? I think in 2017, there's still a lot of truth to that, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, absolutely.
All right, Lee, as always, great stuff. We'll continue doing this and enjoy the rest of this 90-degree day.
Take care, Eric.
All right, very good. He's Lee Hutton, Twin Cities entertainment and sports lawyer. We call the segment Sports in the Courts, and we do it periodically right here on WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
And we're back on a sticky sports Saturday here in the Twin Cities. Temperature right around 90 degrees. Eric Nelson with you. Glad you're along for the ride. And the Minnesota Twins continue to turn back the clock 30 years ago and salute their World Series championship team of 1987. The ceremony started on Thursday. They unveiled the TK statue last night outside of Target Field, and more stuff going on tonight before the game against Detroit. And joining us now is a guy who played on the 87 team, our good friend Al Newman. And Al, first and foremost, it's got to be just fabulous to be able to connect and see all the old guys.
Yeah, Eric, it's a blessing, man. It's been a great weekend, as you mentioned, starting on Thursday. Seeing a few guys you haven't seen in 30 years, but also hooking up with the Herbecks and Laudners and Gladdens, Bert Blylevin and Smalley that I see on a regular basis. So it's good to see the old teammates and to share the Tom Kelly's unveiling of his statue. It's just a blessing to be a part of it.
Tom Kelly, what did he mean for you? You came to Minnesota from Montreal. You played a lot of different positions. You had a role as a utility guy. How did TK help your career?
Well, you know, it's funny you asked me that. I spoke with Skip on Thursday. We were having an event at the stadium on the infield, and I put my arm around him. I just want to thank you for not only being my Skip, but being a mentor, showing me respect for the game and how to play the game, giving me an opportunity. I said I'll never forget the day that you told me that the role that I play is very integral in you being a manager, allowing him to have versatile moves, a variety of moves. So he made me understand what my role was, and I felt good about it. And that was the magic of Tom Kelly. He could be stern, but yet in his own way, he was sensitive. And a lot of people misunderstand that.
And Al, I know you're passionate about the game of baseball. You're still involved in coaching in the Northwoods League. Once upon a time, you were the third base coach for the Minnesota Twins. You were the manager of the Fort Myers Miracle in Class A. So you've been able to, you know, be in that same spot where TK was. Did you take anything out of TK and put it into your managerial style?
Well, I guess I try to say that you can call me Little TK because my managerial style is quite similar to him. I'm straightforward, sometimes blunt, where people think that you're being offensive, but you're really not. It's just your way of motivating the player and getting him to understand that there's more required of him than he acknowledges at this point. That's what I was thanking him for on Thursday, because his credentials speak for themselves. And me as a young manager in 1995, when I had players like Koski and Minkiewicz and Torrey Hunter, young David Arias, who was David Ortiz. You know, I had those guys when they were babies, and I was teaching them. My whole thing was, how are you going to cross the street to play for Tom Kelly? And being a backup player, you learn the ins and outs of the game and understand you must be a student of the game if you're going to be successful.
Yeah, he wanted guys with a high baseball IQ, didn't he?
Oh, most definitely. You had to understand that when he called your name, you were already prepared because you had been paying attention to the flow, the ebbs and flows of a baseball game. And, you know, I don't want to sound like an old guy, but, you know, a lot of players, if they're not in the starting lineup, they figure they got the day off. With Tom Kelly, you didn't have a day off. You just weren't in the beginning portion of the game. But if you're sitting on the bench, the part of the team you're going to be involved in is whether you win or lose that game. And he made that quite evident. And most of the guys, if you look back and think about the two World Series teams, I know there were three bench players on that team, myself, Gene Larkin, and Randy Bush, who he relied on us in pressure situations, and we were able to perform for him.
It's flashback weekend out at Trendy Target Field as the Twins salute the 1987 World Series championship team. Al Newman was part of that group. He's with us now here on WCCO. And Al, you guys may have been one of the most unlikely world championship ball clubs in MLB history, given the fact you only won 85 games in the regular season, but you caught fire against Detroit in the ALCS, and then you were able to outlast St. Louis in the World Series.
Well, I'll tell you what, I never thought about that. It was just one more game than the team that was chasing us. And we were all young, 25, 26, 27. We had, you know, the older guys that we considered at the time, Bert Blylevin, Jeff Reardon, guys like that that helped keep the locker room intact. But we were all hungry, and we're looking to establish ourselves in the major league. You know, good players. I mean, we had four. We had Herbert, Gaetti, Bernanke, who hit over 30 home runs, Puckett hit 28. So we were a power-oriented team, and with that, you know, you had the ebbs and flows of the game when you talk about streak-type situations. But when he pushed in the shove, we bonded together and got it done.
Nobody was closer to Kirby Puckett than you were, Al. He's been gone for a while now, but there's still that huge void. I mean, there's that feeling, wow, Kirby should be here, and it's just so unfortunate that we lost him at such a young age.
Well, you know, it has been a fun weekend, but a tough weekend for me personally. You know, I survived with what took Kirby from us. The next year after I had my brain aneurysm, he died of an aneurysm, and it's not a day that goes by that I don't think of Mr. Puckett. He was a friend, confidant. And you know, when I think of him, it brings a smile to my face. And I know the state of Minnesota missed Kirby too, as well as his teammates. But you're exactly right. Celebrating 30 years without Kirby here, there's always going to be a bit of a void.
I'm not sure there's been a guy, Al, number 34, Kirby Puckett, who was more universally loved by the media, the fans, his teammates, the coaches, and his opponents. I mean, the visiting guys would come to town, and bingo, there's Harold Reynolds, wants to hang out with Kirby. I mean, they all wanted to be a part of Kirby Puckett's little world.
And you know, back then, you used to get fined for fraternization. There was no hugging of your opponent out in center field and all of those things. But when the players on the other teams had a chance during batting practice to stand behind the screen and watch Kirby Puckett, you are totally correct. He was the one guy that I noticed in the league, the other team, Don Mattingly, that opposing players kind of gravitated towards and wanted to at least watch how he did things. Puckett was that guy. He was the happy-go-lucky guy. He was the guy that hustled every day. And players respect that. And that's an attribute that obviously led our team as well as, you know, I hate to talk about Kirby and those descriptive terms because I don't want to knock any other leaders that we had on our team. But Kirby was the guy that everybody knew when he ran down the line at 100%, that meant everybody else had to get that same effort. Not that they didn't want to, but if your leader's doing it, you follow your leader.
Yeah, he definitely had a gravitational pull about him. Everybody wanted to be around Kirby Puckett. How about the 2017 Twins, Al? 30 years later, there are some similarities between this ball club and the one that won that World Series back in 87. First of all, nobody expects the Twins to be where they are now, but they're very much in the AL Central race and the wild card chase. Do you see anything resembling what you guys did and what they're doing now?
Well, I know the Twins have probably two pretty good starting pitchers, and not to knock Les Straker. Les Straker was our third guy in our rotation, and then after that, it was kind of a Juan Berenguer and quite a few other guys who served the rest of the rotation. We were a two-man staff. We did have a pretty good backhand guy with Jeff Reardon, and if Juan Jeff Berenguer didn't start, and he was setting up at that time. He was known as the Terminator, Jeff Reardon. So there are quite a few similarities. There's a young team that's coming together, just like we did in 87. So I'm very proud of this year's team, win or lose. Who would have thought that we would be right in the thick of things towards the end of July? I was hoping for a 500 seed, and hopefully they can win it. Being traded here in 87, I didn't know what the expectations were for the Minnesota Twins. I was just trying to make the team, and lo and behold, I got a ring out of it.
Yeah, and then you got one 4 years later, so you've got two World Series rings. And I think as time goes by, Al, especially the 87 team, the mystique grows because before that, you got to go all the way back to the Minneapolis Lakers of the NBA to find championships in the Twin Cities. The old Minnesota Gopher football teams, but that's decades ago. And then since the Twins won that World Series in 91, all we've really had is the Minnesota Lynx and the Gopher hockey team have won a couple of titles. There's been this big championship void. We haven't had a lot of parades. So the mystique and the stature of you guys continues to grow.
I love it. I'll tell you, Eric, there's not a day that goes by, and as you mentioned earlier in the program, that you know, I still coach college players in St. Cloud. There's not a day that someone in the stands or I pass in the streets doesn't acknowledge the 87-91 World Series team. And it never gets old. It just lets you know how beloved you are in the state of Minnesota. And hopefully this current group one day can live that out. Because I tell you, it's a cherished moment. You never forget it. And nor do I want to.
Before I let you go, Al, you brought up the fans. And you go back to 87, and boy, that fan base was revved up, especially after you beat Detroit to get to the World Series. You come back, and the Metrodome is full. And you had that advantage, that pandemonium inside the dome. It really was such a unique place for opponents to come in and try to figure out how you're going to win a game here. It was a huge advantage, wasn't it?
Oh, it was crazy. It was so tough on opposing players that there were actually players that would not play for the 2 or 3 game series because they were totally intimidated, not only by the fans, but by the roof at the Metrodome. So we had a home field advantage, whether we acknowledged it or not. I always thought that, you know, wouldn't get any wind-blown home runs hit. The weather was never a factor. The best athletes would win the game, the guys with first-step quickness who had good routes to the ball, we win the game, and I know we were built for that. So, you know, when people talk about turning on the fans when we were hitting and all those things, you know what I always say, Eric? And they would have had a little 460 for me because I only hit one major league home run.
Yeah, you were hoping for what, a tornado behind you?
Yeah, there's something there. So, you know, Valentin can take that to the bank.
Great stuff, Al. Hey, enjoy the rest of the weekend. It's magical, and we thank you for sharing your thoughts with us.
All right, you guys have a nice day.
Bye. All right, Al Newman, he was on the 87 and 91 World Series teams for the Twins. This is WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
We've hit the big 9-0, 90 degrees in the Twin Towns, mostly cloudy, northwest wind at 12, dew point 63, so it's still a sauna outside as we are closing in on the 6 o'clock hour. J-Lo, you're a Kansas City guy. This is basically the kind of weather they get typically in Kansas City, St. Louis, another city.
This is
air conditioning for you, isn't
it? This is Tuesday. What are you talking about?
Yeah, you're used to it. I played a flag football game this morning. I got to tell you, I was drenched in warm-ups. Drenched! We hadn't even started.
I am slowly converting to what I'm going to call Minnesota skin. Where you get more acclimated to the Minnesota weather. So 85 to 90, it's always been hot, but you just deal with it. And fortunately, when I was growing up, when the home that we grew up in, we had either ceiling fans, or later on we ended up getting central air. So I did not suffer as much as other people suffered, but, you do deal with it. You go out in it quite a bit. But now I'm starting to grow more acclimated to 40s in September and minus 5 in December. And you
become a heat wind.
I'm so disappointed in myself. So disappointed.
Yeah, it is odd that if you're here long enough and you get a 40-degree day in January, you think it's a heat wave.
That doesn't mean I'm not going to complain about it, because that's what I do. I complain. That's my move.
Well, you're good at complaining.
But it doesn't mean that I haven't grown more acclimated to it.
I remember when the Kansas City Chiefs used to train at Wisconsin River Falls, and I would go over there often to get interviews and watch them practice. It was always a lot of fun. The Cheese League. And I knew some guys who worked at KMBC TV down in Kansas City, Channel 9.
Yeah.
And one of the guys I worked with in the Quad Cities. So they'd come up, they'd be here for a week covering the Chiefs, and you'd see a lot of Missouri plates and Kansas and, you know, Oklahoma Chiefs fans coming and either staying in the Twin Cities or Western Wisconsin, watching the Chiefs, golfing, going to the lakes, that kind of stuff. And I remember we were in late July, early August, we're downtown, Warehouse District, and it was probably a very comfortable, 55, 60 degrees in the evening. And they were like, wow, this is air conditioning. We love this. You know, and that's why the Chiefs were up here for a while, to escape that heat that they get. You know, they get this kind of heat, as you know, every day down there.
Yeah, once you get into July and August, they're going through a heat warning down in northern, basically most of Missouri, the northern half of Missouri. A lot of Kansas, into Iowa, into Illinois, and Nebraska. They're going through heat warnings right now. It's something you expect at least 2 to 3 times a year, where you get not just one day, but probably a week's worth of these heat warnings that go across, because once you get into this hot weather, you get into this hot pattern, jet stream stays north of Iowa, stays north of Minnesota into Canada. There's no breaks.
A few of the hottest baseball games I've ever experienced in my life are St. Louis and Kansas City.
Yes.
I can remember being at the Old Bush in July when they had the AstroTurf, and it was absolutely a sauna. And the same thing at Kauffman, sitting there, as much as I love baseball, sitting there going, I don't know if this is worth it. There was no breeze. You know, it's 90, 95. The humidity's just as high. You're wondering, how am I going to get through 9 innings?
And that's the thing. If you have no clouds, that's the other thing. Have no clouds and it's just the sun's just beating down on you for 3.5-4 hours, it can get a little bit miserable. Because, like you said, once you get – it's not just the fact that it's hot on the turf, but that heat rises. That heat radiates off of the turf,
and into the stands. And so you're feeling it from all sides.
I think legend has it that Willie McGee, the old Cardinal center fielder, burnt his metal spikes on the AstroTurf at the old Busch. And they used to, and you've probably seen this, you'd watch a game, they'd drop a thermometer onto the AstroTurf at Royal Stadium Busch, and it would be 140.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how in the world is Willie McGee or whoever standing out there in the outfield
Willie
and
Wilson
dealing with that?
Willie Wilson or just amazing. Danny Tartable. Or
and thank goodness they have grass now at the new Busch and Kauffman, but wow.
It's a wonder we survived.
Yeah, well, it's there's a lot of things I wonder about.
The concrete jungles of Kansas City and St. Louis are once you get in the summer, it's a cooker, and most times it's a cooker, and usually you'll have again weeks at a time where you're trying to stay inside because the heat index outside is 105 to 110. Again, it's not the same as Phoenix or Las Vegas.
Desert heat.
Desert heat. It's not the same as dry heat, and that's the worry. Because if it does get up to 110 in Kansas City or St. Louis or Little Rock or Memphis or Wichita,
no, you're toast. You may as well not come outside. Yeah. Now we're up to 90 currently, and we have a bit of a breeze out of the northwest at 12. But the beauty of Minnesota is that's why I never complain about the heat in Minnesota, because it's usually a hiccup. It's here today, gone tomorrow, and that's going to be the case. We're going to have a very good Sunday tomorrow, right? We're going to slowly lose the humidity, dry out a bit.
We may get a week or two where it sticks around.
This has been
for a
sticky week.
Yeah, but we're north enough, we're far north enough where we can't quite, unless there's a big dome of high pressure that covers the central middle of the country, the central third, central 40% of the country. We'll usually see the jet stream come and go, and we'll see, you know, cold fronts come through and warm fronts come up and everything. So we're in a very interesting location weather-wise because atmospheric-wise because, again, it's far enough north where you'll get those heat spells, but we're far enough south where the jet stream is not going to stay up in Canada all summer. It just doesn't do it.
Yeah. So there you go. Heat lesson from J-Lo, Jonathan Lowe. Once again, 90 degrees, mostly cloudy, wind out of the northwest at 12. Twins and Tigers start in 9 minutes at Trendy Target Field. The Saints and Salina tonight at 7:10 over at Scenic CHS. This is WCCO.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.